from the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. Today on the program, we'll be speaking with Kathy Searle, Utah Director of Programs at the Adoption Exchange, and we'll look at the more than 400,000 children who are living without permanent families in the foster care system in the United States.
This child had no choice at all for me to be their parent. I had the choice. So I need to be the adult, and I need to be the one that's calm and that models the appropriate behavior that I want from them and seek out the resources that I need to do the proper job of parenting this child.
That conversation, plus a look at a ruling by a federal judge calling Utah's Amendment 3 unconstitutional, and the latest findings from the House committee investigating former Attorney General John Swallow. All that just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. And thanks once again for tuning into The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Later on the show, we're going to be having a conversation about foster care and adoption in Utah. But first up, we have these headlines. A federal judge ruled today that Utah's Amendment 3 barring same-sex marriage is unconstitutional. As a result, Salt Lake County Deputy Clerk Danelle Burton Lee says the district attorney authorized her office to begin issuing the marriage licenses Friday, though she couldn't immediately say how many licenses have been issued so far. U.S. District Judge Robert Shelby ruled earlier in the afternoon that the amendment violates gay and lesbian couples' rights to due process and equal protection under the 14th Amendment. Shelby said the state failed to show that allowing same-sex marriages would affect opposite-sex marriages in any way. ACLU Director Karen McCreary applauded the decision.
I think it's just such an incredibly wonderful, constitutionally strong decision that the court wrote today, and very clearly drew, you know, parallels to other cases, similar times that have overturned, you know, discriminatory laws on the basis of race. So I think it's right where it needs to be, and it's very exciting to see that happen here in the federal court in Utah.
The Utah Attorney General's Office released a statement saying that the federal district court's ruling that same-sex marriage is a fundamental right has never been established in any previous case in the 10th Circuit. The state says it is requesting an emergency stay pending the filing of an appeal to the ruling. The lawsuit was brought by three gay and lesbian couples in Utah. Many similar court challenges are pending in other states, but Utah's has been closely watched because of the state's history of staunch opposition to gay marriage as the home of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The House Special Investigative Committee investigating allegations against former Attorney General John Swallow held their second and final day of hearings on Friday. During Thursday's hearings, Special Counsel Steve Reich set out to establish a pattern of evidence fabrication and destruction by Swallow. Reich argued that Swallow was attempting to evade investigators. And now here's KCPW's Ryan Cunningham to break down some of the details from Friday's hearing.
On Thursday, the House committee investigating former Utah Attorney General John Swallow learned of the distance to which Swallow went to obscure his actions. On Friday, the committee got a look at Swallow's involvement in some less than flattering dealings. Special Counsel Jim Mintz and his team of investigators built the case that Swallow was involved in a pay-to-play scheme with the Utah payday loan industry. In a 2011 email, Swallow made an appeal to payday loan interests, saying that if they contributed to his campaign, he would, quote, go to bat for the payday loan industry. In the same email, Swallow offered instructions on how to contribute to his as-of-yet-unannounced campaign, expressing his preference to keep the payday loans issue out of the public campaign. So Swallow and his supporters used what investigators have called a, quote, daisy chain of nonprofit organizations and political action committees, or PACs, to hide the identity of donors. In one case, as Special Counsel Steve Reich notes, a $5,000 donation from Cash America was reported as a campaign donation, even though the organization receiving the donation was a nonprofit, not a political organization.
The reporting of this money by Cash America accurately, in our view, reflects what the money was and certainly reflects how Cash America viewed the money it had given.
According to the investigators, money from the payday loan industry eventually ended up being spent on attack ads against Swallow's opponent, Sean Reyes. An email exchange about those radio and TV ads seemed to suggest that Swallow and his campaign may have coordinated with the It's Now or Never PAC on those ads. Ironically, the attack ad in question takes Reyes to task for his, quote, major ethics issues. Questions were also raised about Swallow's connections to push polling and a campaign mailer slamming a state representative who favored tighter restrictions on payday loan businesses. In light of these findings, some members of the committee expressed an interest in continuing the investigation. Here's Representative Mike McKell.
Maybe if I run, when I run for re-election, maybe I'm going to have Energy Alternatives come after me. Maybe I'll have It's Now or Never come after me. Maybe Crossroad Media. Maybe the proper role of government education associates is going to come after me. But I don't care. This is serious, and I'll go on the record that I think there's a strong likelihood that somebody should go to jail for what's been done.
The scandal may only grow as we head into the new year. Swallow's predecessor, Mark Shurtleff, has had a warrant issued for his cell phone records. Ryan Cunningham, KCPW News.
And we should note that those hearings were continuing as of 5 p.m. Utah Representative Jim Matheson announced earlier this week that he would not be running for Congress again next year. So what's the inside scoop? I posed that question to Thomas Burr, Washington correspondent for the Salt Lake Tribune and an author of Political Cornflakes, a daily online roundup of Utah politics.
Well, just because he's not running in 2014 doesn't mean he won't be running in 2016. So I think we're looking at a little positioning, to be honest. Congressman Matheson knows that this next year is going to be a tough race. It's always tough in off years when there's no presidential election for incumbents, especially incumbent Democrats to run when a Democrat's in the White House. So it'd be a tough race, and it's not something that Matheson obviously wants to lose. You can't, run for higher office after losing something. So bowing out now, not running again in 2014, allows him, kind of go off on a good note, start raising money, raise your profile in Utah, connect with people back there, and possibly run for Senate or governor. I will tell you, my conversation with Matheson this week, I asked him specifically if his decision not to run for the House again means that he would run for the Senate or governor in 2016, and his response was, yes, sir.
Yes, sir, but not defining which one necessarily.
Exactly, and no official confirmation that he's going to run, but he's considering it.
In other news, Thomas, a panel reviewing the NSA's spying suggested some sweeping changes this week. Is that going to have an effect on the data center here in Utah?
So as far as we know, it will have zero impact on the data center. I shouldn't say zero. It may have like a very minor impact. But essentially, this review panel, former intelligence officials, national security advisors, came back and said, there are some major problems with what the NSA is doing, and it's not really, this whole dragnet taking all of the phone records and such isn't really helping to knock down any terrorism problems. So they're suggesting a lot of different things, including one that it looks like the White House is fully on board with, which is that the telephony metadata, those records that we're all concerned about, would be kept by the phone carriers and not by the government. Therefore, if the government all of a sudden needs to have Roger McDonough's phone records, they'd have to go to Verizon or AT&T or wherever you might phone with instead of having them already in their hands. But that's really not a major part of what the data center does. So the Utah data center is supposed to, suck in information from all over the world and not necessarily just worry about the domestic stuff. So it's really kind of may have a minor impact on the data center.
Great. And then finally, Thomas, today, John Huntsman is selling his home in D.C. Does that mean that he's leaving Washington?
I would love to answer that, and I really don't know, to be honest. I've asked his people, and pretty much they're saying they can't say anything at the moment. So all we know is that Huntsman bought the house in 2009, I think, in D.C. It's a nice swanky area of Washington. I've been to the home. It's fairly nice. And he bought it for $3.6 million, and now it's on the market for $4.1 million. It could mean a bunch of things. It could mean that he's found a better house in D.C. that he wants to move to. Maybe he wants to buy a bigger house in Salt Lake and get rid of the condo he has in Salt Lake. It could also mean he didn't get that big white house on 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, so he doesn't really want to live in Washington anymore.
But no portent on his political future necessarily there.
No, we'll see where he buys next. Could be New Hampshire. Who knows?
Great. Thomas, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Roger.
Thomas Burr is a Washington correspondent with Salt Lake Tribune and an author of Political Cornflakes, a daily online roundup of Utah politics. We speak with Burr weekly, and there's a link to Political Cornflakes on our website, kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. Stay with us. In the U.S., over 400,000 children are living without permanent families in the foster care system. More than a quarter are eligible for adoption, but nearly 40% of these children will wait over 3 years in foster care before being adopted. According to the Utah Department of Human Services, Child and Family Services, on any given day in the state of Utah, approximately 2,500 children are in state custody because their primary caretakers are currently unable to care for them. On average, 15 to 20% of those children will not be able to return home, and they will need another permanent family. Today on The Rundown, we will be speaking with Kathy Searle, Utah Director of Programs at the Adoption Exchange, a nonprofit organization which works to make the connections between families who adopt and children who wait for a family to care for them. Through a contract with the Utah Department of Human Services, Child and Family Services, the Adoption Exchange manages the Utah Adoption Connection website. Children who are in need of adoption are posted on the website. The goals are to decrease the time children must wait in foster care for a permanent family, make it easier for social workers to find out about possible families, and increase the availability of post-adoption resources. Kathy, thank you for being here today. And so your organization, the Adoption Exchange, deals with adoption, but to start, can we discuss foster care since this is kind of the first step? Why are children placed in foster homes? For how long are they placed there, and where do they go after that if they aren't adopted by a foster family?
Well, there's usually a call that goes into Child Protective Services from the community of somebody who's worried about children, and they go out and do an investigation. Their primary goal is to keep children in the home. So if there's something that they can provide, training or, you know, help of some kind, then they will do that to keep the children in the home. But if the children are unsafe in the home and there's been neglect or abuse by the caregivers and they don't feel like that they can maintain the children safely in that environment, then they do come into foster care. They try to get them as quickly as possible into a foster home. We do have the Christmas Box House here in Salt Lake and in Ogden and I think Moab, where children can go temporarily while a family is being located. But the goal is to keep those kids in a shelter-type placement or emergency placement in a real short period of time and back into a family environment.
So I was reading about a 90-day volunteer foster care placement. I guess I don't understand that 90-day maximum voluntary foster care placement.
A voluntary foster care placement is typically for teenagers. Mm-hmm. So if you have an ungovernable teen and you're arguing and things aren't going well, then you can do a 90-day voluntary. It means that the parent is voluntarily placing the child in custody for those 90 days. Sometimes it's used as a cooling-off period, things like that. Another situation that's probably less common is, say, you have a single mom that lives here in Salt Lake City and becomes ill or gets in a car accident and has absolutely no family and she cannot care for her children. Then she could voluntarily place them there until she gets out of the hospital and is able to care for them again.
For kids who are, who go into this, how is a permanent home determined? How do kids, how are they placed in permanent homes?
Well, when they first come into foster care, the goal is always reunification with the parents. I mean, once in a great while, if this parent has had other situations with the court may not offer reunification and go straight to adoption or other permanent custody or guardianship. But the majority of the time, they want to do reunification with the parents. So they're going to work that plan. And usually, the courts will do 2 6-month treatment plans with a biological parent for children over the age of 3. For younger children, so 36 months or younger, they're going to try and get those kids determined whether they're going to go home or be adopted within about a 6 to 8 month period. Mm. Because we know that children that are that young, to bounce them from place to place to place causes long-term damage. We know that. That's so traumatic for these kids that it really interrupts their, almost the chemical makeup of their brain because of the trauma. So the courts like to move those cases along a little bit more quickly than they do the older children. Also, the older children have that bond with their parents and they want to go home. Even in situations where there's been horrific abuse and neglect, most kids want to go home. They want to go back to their parents.
Mm, right. Well, that's what they know. There's in 2003, a survey of 33 European countries carried out under the auspices of the World Health Organization found a, quote, risk of harm in terms of attachment disorder, developmental delay, and neural atrophy in the developing brains. This is kind of the chemical makeup you were describing, and showed that on average, children reared in orphanages had IQs that were 20 points lower than those raised in foster care. As a result, there's been recommendations that as an overriding principle that children younger than three, like you're saying, mm-hmm. 36 months or younger, not be placed in institutions without a parent or a primary caregiver. So these placements are really important, and finding that permanent placement is really important. Obviously, you've said that the objective is to get them back in with their biological parents, but that doesn't always happen. I'm wondering, I know that Child and Family Services applies the same standards to adoptive families as it does to foster families, and I'm wondering if you could describe who is eligible for adoption.
For foster care adoption and to become a foster parent, we're trying to screen people in because we have children waiting. In private adoption, because we have couples waiting, they try to screen out. So the even the word eligible, it really refers more to private adoption because you have to fit a criteria to become an adoptive parent because there's very few infants available to be adopted. When you come to foster care adoption, it totally flips that on its head, and we're trying to find families for children who are waiting. And I always say children are like bananas. They don't last long. They spoil.
They grow up.
Yeah, they need love and care from a family. And so being eligible is not so much of the issue. A lot of people think the myths out there are that they have to own their own home. They don't have to. Hmm. That maybe they're too old. There's no age requirement. The only age requirement the state of Utah has is that you have to be 10 years older than the child you adopt. So the high end of that, obviously they're not going to place a newborn with a 65-year-old couple.
Right.
But they definitely would consider a 65-year-old couple for a 17 or 18-year-old that possibly could be aging out soon.
Okay. But so there, for children who are in foster care, that the sort of standards are flipped on their head. But there are some state laws governing this as well. I mean, you have to be married. Is that correct?
To adopt, you can't be a cohabitating couple. Mm. You have to be married, or you have to be related by blood, marriage, or adoption.
What about single individuals?
Single individuals can adopt and do adopt. The statistics are that there's quite a few single women, less for single men. But there are single men that do adopt. Over the years, I've known quite a few, and especially for some of our older teen boys, do a very good job with becoming foster and adoptive parents.
How do these eligibility requirements, or maybe that's not the right term, but how do those kinds of requirements stack up against other states? I'm actually thinking here about same-sex couples that obviously can't adopt because they can't be married here
right.
in the state.
Right.
So in other states, you could be a same-sex couple and probably adopt if you were married, and maybe you don't even have to be married in other states.
I would think in other states you probably don't have to be married. I know nationally, one of the things that's coming out is that one of the best populations to look at for more homes so that children don't have to wait is the LGBT community, and that the research that's gone into that has shown that they do very, very well. And regardless of what your personal values and ethics are, when children's only other option is foster care for life and aging out, which the statistics that the Pew Commission had gathered is nationally, that 67% of children who age out of the foster care system, and there was over 200 last year from Utah, within 1 year, they will be dead, homeless, or in prison. So if you compare that to allowing possibly a same-sex couple to raise a child and increase the odds of this child not being homeless, dead, or in prison, I think when you look at it from that vantage point, it takes on a different connotation. I mean, if you're looking, again, if it's between private adoption and foster care adoption, the rules are totally different because private adoption, families are waiting. Mm-hmm. And foster care adoption, children are waiting.
Right. I'm thinking about the cost. I mean, you talk about this not being an ideological issue. I'm thinking about the cost to society also when you have children who do and you say age out of the system. Maybe we should get a definition of that. That's so they turn 18. Is this right? And then they're out of the system.
Basically, they start usually a program called Transition to Adult Living around 15, 16 years of age, where they teach the kids how to budget, how to cook, how to clean, all of those kinds of things that you would learn in a family. Mm-hmm. That many times in foster homes, you know, they may learn, they may not learn. They could be in group homes, they could have been residential treatment facilities, things like that. So they try their best to give them those skills, but anybody who's ever raised a teenager realizes that, you know, 16, 17, 18-year-old most of the time they're not ready to be on their own. So what happens if a child turns 18 and they want to leave care, then they can tell the judge, I want to be gone. Now, we have some kids that say, you know, I'm not ready. They realize they're not ready. And they won't age out until they're 19, 20, 21. But that's up to the discretion of the court.
Mm, okay. You know, so you've been describing, I'm just thinking for a second that I can't remember if we defined this or not, but you were describing the private adoption system in which parents are waiting, and generally they're waiting for infants.
Correct.
And then there's this system that we're kind of focusing on today, which is the foster care adoption, mm-hmm. In which the kids are waiting. Mm-hmm. And I imagine do you have couples who are looking at adopting, or individuals, as we've described, who you know, are looking at infants but then are swayed to say, hey, you know what, there are people who are waiting here who need a loving home, and we can provide that. Does that happen often?
I think it does. I think a lot of adoptive parents will come to adoption and maybe adopt an infant or two maybe, and because of the cost that goes along with that and the availability of infants, they might, you know, their heart is kind of drawn towards these children who are waiting. And so many of the families that come forward to adopt older children are already adopted through private agencies and attorneys. Hmm. So, I mean, and they're really good candidates because they kind of already know the ropes. The adoption process is not easy, regardless of which type of adoption that you do. There's a lot of paperwork. There's training that you need to take. I mean, they get medical information from you, financial information from you. They talk to your neighbors and relatives. I mean, what we're doing is we're trying our best to ensure that when a child is placed into an adoptive home that they're safe.
Right.
And that the parents have the capacity to raise them. And so we do our best efforts to try to cover that. But as you know, human nature, people change. People sometimes aren't honest. Mm. Sometimes people are put into situations where their life changes dramatically. And so things that would have never happened 5 years ago are now a possibility in that family because life is hard sometimes.
Actually, I'm wondering about how long that process takes. And I have a follow-up question, which I'll ask afterwards, but I'll kind of lay out for you now, which is, do you have instances in which, I mean, how frequent is the instance in which somebody adopts a child and then doesn't stick with it, or the state has to intervene to make it
right? Right. It's basically the same process as with a biological family. They want to relinquish their rights. Nationally, there's kind of a rehoming, is what they're calling it, where a family feels like they're not equipped to meet the child's needs, whether that's mental health issues or whatever it is. Going back to that brain, you know, the brain development and the trauma and those things that happen to kids who've suffered neglect and abuse, and sometimes parents aren't ready for that. And so and the number is really very low for the most part. Even really hard kids stay with their families, and families rely on extended family just like they do for their birth children. So maybe the child goes and lives with Aunt Sally for 6 months while, you know, everybody just has a rest, or, you know, grandparents sometimes step in. So when it happens, it's so tragic that we all go, oh my gosh, that's so terrible. And how could they do that after they, you know, they wanted this child. They went through all that paperwork and they paid all that money, and now they want to give them away. It's a lot more complex than that. But it doesn't really happen all that often. The state of Utah does try to put in supports for families, regardless of where the child has been adopted through. However, their main funding is for children who've been adopted through the foster care system. So if you bring a child from another country and you're struggling, they're going to be able to provide some community resources and maybe help you out. But if you've adopted from the foster care system, you have already a Medicaid card for your child. And usually there's a monthly maintenance payment that can be adjusted up if the needs of the child grow. Mm-hmm. So the child's placed at 3, but at 13, very different issues, and maybe the family originally got, you know, $100 a month subsidy. They can go back to the state and say, these are the needs right now, and we're struggling to meet the needs. And the committee can look at the documentation, talk with the parents, and maybe the committee will decide, you know, this family really needs like $400 to really meet the needs of this child. But private and international, that's not available. Mm-hmm. Because they went outside of the foster care system to take on a child sometimes that has the exact same needs that the kids in our foster care system do.
But now I'm going to go back to the original question, which is, you kind of addressed this a little bit, but what are the steps and costs, or specifically, how long does it take for a family to adopt a child out of foster care? There are all of these checks, and you say they look into the paperwork and the families.
Mm-hmm.
They want to talk to your cousins and uncles or whoever. and who approves these placements?
Well, the first question of how long it takes, I like to tell families 6 to 9 months, and they're shocked because when they see Wednesday's child, they're thinking, man, I'll just say, yeah, I can take that child in my home, and they think it will happen in a few weeks. But the process is lengthy, and the process is complicated. And part of that, I think, is our effort to ensure that the family really knows and understands what they're getting into, mm-hmm. and that they can make that long-term commitment, because these children have already had enough disruption in their lives. We don't want to cause another one. So the training itself is 32 hours that the families have to take. And not only are they learning parenting techniques and things like that, but they're also learning about how a child is changed when they've suffered neglect mm-hmm. and abuse. And a child is changed. All of us are changed when we experience any kind of trauma. And so you may have raised your biological children and just done this fantastic job, and you think, I can do this. And you probably can. But if you haven't raised a child that's experienced trauma, you need some extra training and help. So, I mean, people can do it probably in a little less time than that. Several years ago, we adopted through the foster care system. Very experienced parents. I knew all the people. Mm-hmm. Hand-carried all my stuff, and it still took me, I want to say, 3 to 4 months.
Right. I was going to ask you about that. And who approves that process in the end?
Okay. What happens is after the training and all the paperwork is gathered, then the Office of Licensing, their mandate is to take all that information, and they're looking for health and safety. So they come out to the home. They make sure that there's no dangerous situations. They talk with the parents, both of the parents. They talk with the children that may already be in the home. And they kind of do a basic health and safety. Once they've completed that, then it goes to the Division of Child and Family Services. They review everything. Their mandate is not health and safety. Their mandate's everything.
From finances to
everything. The psychological health of the parent, to their physical health. They're going to look at every little piece of that home study. And can this family really take on the challenge of raising a child who suffered abuse and neglect? They're going to look at that. Once it's approved through that committee, then a child can be placed in the home.
So you yourself have adopted children from the foster care system?
Yeah, we've adopted privately here in the States 2 infants. We've adopted 2 out of foster care system here in the States. And then we have 4 kids that we adopted internationally. All but one of those was adopted at an older age. So those children have many of the same characteristics that children in foster care have because we adopted them older. So even if people will say, well, aren't there just some children that maybe their parents have passed away and so they haven't really suffered? And it's like, if both your parents are dead, you've suffered.
Right. Yeah.
And there's trauma there. And so they may not have suffered extreme abuse, but when you bring a child away from everything they've ever known their entire life, that is trauma. To a country where they don't understand the language, they don't even really know you, that's trauma again right there. And a lot of people think, oh, international will be better because those kids are just in an orphanage and they haven't suffered abuse and neglect. But many times, especially kids coming out of Russia and Ukraine, places like that, a lot of the issues that brought those kids to the orphanage are the same issues that bring kids to our foster care system here. There's a lot of alcohol abuse there, so we see fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. We see very many of the similar things that we're seeing here in our foster care system. So people are hoping to have as close to a biological child as they can, an infant, but really, I don't know that that's really possible. I mean, even I have biological children too. And I tell my parents when I train families, I say, you know, parenting's a crapshoot. You don't know what you're going to get. Mm-hmm. When you adopt from the foster care system and you adopt an older child, at least you have an idea. When you adopt an infant, it's like an unopened package. You're not going to know for a while what challenges
right.
that you're going to have. And, I mean, we always hope that you have a child that is obedient and that you know, makes the honor roll and does all those great things that we hope as parents our children want to be. And it's great when that happens. But even with biological children, a lot of families have some of the similar struggles that adoptive families have.
Right. You know, I'm wondering about the, you know, you're talking about adoptions from Ukraine and Russia. I'm wondering if if that's the way most people go is to look internationally for infants or to look for infant adoptions as opposed to, I mean, is that the more common form of adoption?
Well, I think when you say the word adoption, people think babies. Because of our culture, that's, you just think a baby. So when a couple comes to adoption, whether it's through infertility or just want to build their family in a different way, many times they're thinking an infant. And it's places and organizations like the Adoption Exchange where we talk to them more about all the possibilities. And there are families that come in and say, you know, we did the diaper thing and we really don't want to do that anymore. We want a toddler or school age. And private adoption, generally speaking, doesn't do that. So if you're looking for a child, say, 5 and up, you're going to have to adopt internationally or through the foster care system because private agencies really aren't equipped to do that work. They work with biological couples who want to place their unborn child for adoption.
Got it. What are some of the things to consider when fostering or adopting a child? You yourself having gone through this process, what are things that people ought to be considering? I know there's like adopting that child's biological family as your extended family could mm-hmm. be one part of mm-hmm. it. You know, you could adopt two siblings who are at the same time. I mean, what are some things that people might not consider?
I think what you really need to consider is being flexible and being open. And because adoption, when you come to adoption, there's usually a checklist that they'll give you of things that you want to accept and not accept. And so in a way, it's almost like when you go online to buy a car and you get to like design it yourself. You know, you get to pick red, blue, or green, and you're saying, well, I don't really want to parent a child who's been sexually abused. And so we set adoptive families up in a way to think that this checklist is what they're going to get. And in actuality, they're all just kids. And most of the time, you really don't know what you're getting until you've got it. And a lot of times, kids who come adopted internationally and adopted from the foster care system have some dark secrets. And the interesting thing is many times it takes years for those to come out because they have to feel comfortable enough with you to share that secret. And a lot of times there's a lot of really hard behaviors that go around that. And so for families to be open-minded, to be flexible, to have the stability that they need. And then one of the biggest things for parenting in general, whether adoption or otherwise, is to not take things personally. A lot of things that these kids do are highly annoying.
A lot of things that any kids do are highly,
highly annoying. But you've got to be flexible. And in your mind, you have to think, this child is my responsibility. I came forward. They didn't have a choice. This child had no choice at all for me to be their parent. I had the choice. So I need to be the adult and I need to be the one that's calm and that models the appropriate behavior that I want from them and seek out the resources that I need to do the proper job of parenting this child. But you've got to be very self-aware and very flexible. And your goals might change for your children. When we adopted our first older child, our goal became productive citizen. If we can have a productive citizen, then we will be successful. Where prior to that, you know, we wanted college graduates. Yeah. We wanted model citizens, honor roll students, all of that. You have to kind of change what your reality is.
You know, we talked about aging out of the system quite a bit. And there's, there's so much to go into here.
It's a big topic.
It is a big topic. You know, they have all of these problems, but there's a study out there that shows that 70% of all youth in foster care have the desire to attend college. And that seems to suggest that it's not an unwillingness, but that there aren't services or safety nets in place for youth who age out of the system to be able to succeed. And I'm wondering if there are still services available to the youth who age out of the system. Once they are out of the system, are they're just adults? Is that it? And they're on their own?
They're basically on their own. The state has provided they can go to a state school tuition free. But anybody who's been to college knows that the tuition is one part of getting into college and staying there, that it can be really tricky just to apply and fulfill all the admission requirements. And even nowadays, if you don't have access to the internet, I don't know how you would even do college.
Right.
Because everything that you need to do pretty much is online. So There are kids through the help of Transition to Adult Living that are able to make that leap. However, I have a good friend that runs Voice for Adoption back in Washington, D.C. And she aged out of the system in Oregon. She got accepted to Portland State, and she actually made it to college. And she describes crying herself to sleep every night because she had that loss. She wasn't connected to anyone. And all of her roommates were getting care packages from home. And at college, they were doing parent day and, you know, all these activities. And she really didn't – she knew she didn't have a family, but she didn't really know what to do about it. And she got involved with a program called Foster Club and a program called Getting Solid. And she was like, oh, well, is this what permanency is? This is what I need in my life to be happy? And she said what she did is she created her own permanence by becoming good friends with her friends' parents and their families. Mm. So she created permanency for herself. So we owe these kids a lot more than just free tuition at a state school. They need connections to people that can help them emotionally as well and jump through those hoops to even get into college.
You know, and there's something to be said about the failure of society for the fact that these kids end up where they end up. I mean, we as a nation, as a society, somehow are allowing that to happen. I mean,
our definition of an adult is an 18-year-old person. And I don't know about you, but lots of 18-year-olds, they can be very, very great individuals, but are they able to make lots of adult decisions? Sometimes not. And research is saying that most kids live with their parents until they're 26.
Hey, so finally, I want to ask about the resources available to people who are interested in adopting.
They can go to Utah's Adoption Connection website. They can request a general information packet. There's also FAQs on that and just general information that will give them basically what we talked about, the process. They can call the Adoption Exchange, and we can kind of walk them through the process so they kind of know the ins and the outs of it and then, you know, get into the training and get the process going.
There may be people out there who have considered adopting, but they, you know, it's making that step. You know, you actually have to, you say, oh, you know, I'd love to do this. But, yeah, you know, maybe there's a lack of people with, you know, who are willing to open their hearts up. Maybe now's a time to make an appeal to them. I'm trying to come up with a good question for this, Kathy.
You know, what I tell people a lot is not everybody can have a child come into their home for a variety of reasons. But you can be aware that there are children in our community that don't have parents. And you can be aware of families who do that and bring kids into their home, and you can support those families. You can become a mentor. We have a mentor program. You can volunteer at Christmas Box House at the shelter. You can get involved with our organization. Right now, we're just finishing up Sub for Santa for over 400 children that are in foster care, and we have a staff of like 6 people. There's a variety of ways to be involved. If your heart is drawn to this work, there's a variety of ways to be involved, and you should be involved because that's where your heart is, and you don't have to bring a child into your home to make a difference.
Fantastic. Kathy Searle, Utah Director of Programs at the Adoption Exchange, thanks for coming in and speaking with us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Of course. That was Kathy Searle, Utah Director of Programs at the Adoption Exchange. There's quite a bit more to this interview, which you can find at our website, along with all of our past interviews at kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. We'll be right back. That's all the time we have for our show today. The Rundown was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis, Tyler Ford, and Ryan Cunningham. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. One final follow-up to our story on a federal judge striking down Utah's Amendment 3 prohibiting same-sex marriage. In the wake of that ruling, Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker, in a video posted to the Facebook page of advocacy group Equality Utah, says he will perform as many marriages as he can this evening at the City and County Building. The Rundown will be on hiatus for the rest of the year, but we look forward to exploring more local news, current events, and issues that matter to you in 2014. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next.